Hey guys, welcome to the podcast. You're listening to Ag Talk with the Ag Doc, and I'm your host, Dr. Curtis Livesey. Here's a rundown of today's episode. First, we'll cover what's up in the world of ag, and today's news stories include the USDA's July 27th crop progress report and the farming magazine that every grower should subscribe to. Next, we'll check back in with Ben Peterson, one of our Dynamite Grower correspondents from North Central Iowa. And finally, today's main segment is all about fungicide. All right, let's do this.
You're listening to Ag Talk with the Ag Doc, presented by Dynamite Ag. Now, here's your host, Dr. Curtis Livesey.
Welcome everybody to Ag Talk with the Ag Doc. Now, before I get started with today's podcast, I want to issue a sincere apology. It's been roughly 4 weeks since the release of my last podcast, and that may not seem like a big deal to you. However, I didn't give you, my listeners, any warning I was going to take so long in getting this episode out. Relatedly, because this episode is all about fungicide, I understand I've actually missed the window for many of you to be able to actually go out and do anything with the info that we're going to cover today, and I feel bad about that. I've been traveling a whole bunch since the last episode, and more specifically, I've actually spent time with growers in 8 different states since the release of the last podcast. Now, that's no excuse for not being more timely in this show's release, but I just at least wanted to give you a heads up as to where I've been for the month of July and to apologize for my absence. And while I'm on this topic, I should also tell you that the next episode won't be out for another couple of weeks as well, because I am going to Idaho and to Washington this weekend to visit some growers out there, and then I'll be attending the Global Leadership Summit, which is put on by the Willow Creek Church Association the week after that. So anyway, I do just want to give you a little preview of some of the things that we've got lined up or the episodes coming up in the weeks ahead. I will be covering some topics like earthworms. We'll do an episode on the potassium paradox. We'll probably do a whole series on nitrogen management related topics, and there's a whole bunch of other great stuff coming as well. So have no fear, I'm not going away, I'm just really busy. Now with that said, let's move on to today's topic. Today's podcast is about fungicide. However, I want to give you a heads up front that when I say fungicide, today I'm really mostly referring to the pyraclostrobin fungicides. So in other words, I'll be talking about the stuff mostly from BASF's line, including products like Headline and Preaxor. And there's a couple reasons for this. First of all is really brevity. I've only got so many minutes for the show, and I've got a ton of information, which is another reason why this particular episode took so long to get out. I had to sort through a whole lot of data and a whole lot of information to put this together. So mostly brevity. I had to figure out what to keep and what to cut. Secondly, as I'll discuss more in depth later, my interpretation of the data from the Iowa Soybean Association's on-farm research clearly suggests to me anyway that the pyraclostrobin fungicides seem to be the most effective fungicides in Iowa, and I'll explain more about that. Thirdly, they are certainly the most widely used and most widely researched fungicides. And finally, I was able to get an excellent interview with a couple of guys at BASF about pyraclostrobin, so that's kind of the reasoning for the structure of the show today. Now, before we dive into the fungicide discussion, though, let's take a look at what's up in the world of ag. We'll start with the USDA's July 27th crop progress report. As I said just a moment ago, I haven't been on the air in about a month, but if you followed the weather and crop-related news at all, you probably know that the trends of water problems that we saw early on this year throughout a good portion of the lower Midwest are still the trends that we're seeing today. More specifically, just about half of the Missouri corn crop is rated good or excellent, and the other half is anywhere from fair to very poor. And Kansas was another state that was really wet early on, and they're slightly better than Missouri, with just under 60% of the crop rated good to excellent and about 42% rated as fair all the way down to very poor. Now, as a side note, I've been talking to some of our growers out in western Kansas who usually have to irrigate. Of course, there's the whole big water controversy going on out in that region with the problems they're having with the Ogallala Aquifer right now. This year, however, they tell me they've not had to do a lot of irrigating, or at least not nearly as much as normal, so hopefully this year's wet conditions will help to alleviate some of that stress over the aquifer issue out that way. Unlike early in the growing season, some other states have joined Missouri and Kansas in the land of oversaturation. Specifically, Illinois and especially Indiana have been hit really hard with way too much water over the course of the last 6 or 8 weeks. And according to the USDA's report, 45% of the Illinois crop is good, with 12% rated as excellent, while almost 30% is only fair and the remainder is either poor or very poor. Indiana is in worse shape yet, with just over 10% excellent, 35% rated as good, and over half of the Indiana crop is rated fair all the way down to very poor. Obviously, then, my home state of Iowa is the big winner of the I-States this year. Almost a quarter of the crop in Iowa is rated excellent. 60% is good. Now, I've been all over the state of Iowa this year, and I can tell you, if you're wondering exactly where the best crops are, it's in northern Iowa. In fact, it really seems like there's going to be a yield gradient across my favorite state this year, such that the best average yields, now I'm not talking there won't be some good yields in some other places, but the best average yields will likely happen north of Highway 20, with very good yields down south to about Interstate 80, and then it actually starts to taper off rather quickly the further south you go from there. I grew up in Van Buren County, which is right on the Missouri state line, and my family's still there, and we work with a lot of growers over around Centerville, Iowa, which is about 60 miles west of Van Buren County. And I can tell you firsthand that the southern tier of counties in Iowa has been hit hard with some of those same storms that seem to be ravishing Missouri growers this year. So there's your breakdown for Iowa. Unsurprisingly, Minnesota seems to be the biggest winner this year of the weather lottery, as they report 87% of their corn crop is good to excellent. And Wisconsin's in pretty good shape with 82% good to excellent. North Dakota is in similar shape with 80% good to excellent on the corn crop. As we move on to soybeans, we see that Indiana, Illinois, Kansas, and Missouri are all behind their five-year trend lines for soybean blooming for this week, while Iowa and Nebraska pretty much are right on track with the norms, and Minnesota is way ahead of normal with 90% bloom in their soybeans compared to their five-year average of just 73%. There's a similar trend across the Midwest for soybean-setting pods, but the big number to pay attention to here comes from Missouri again. Only 10% pod set in Missouri soybeans right now, which is just over half of their five-year average. North Dakota and Minnesota are again the big winners on soybean condition rating, with 81% and 80% respectively rated good to excellent. And I'm going to save you the depressing specifics, but you can imagine that Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas are at the opposite end of the spectrum, given the rest of the crop progress report to this point. The winter wheat harvest is mostly done throughout the Midwest, or getting close to it, although it's just getting good and started out in Idaho, so hopefully I'll have a little first-hand experience and info on that when I get back from my trip out there this weekend. So that is your July 27th, 2015 USDA Crop Progress Report. Next, we move on to our second article, which is, what is the single most important agricultural publication that you should be reading? Well, I got to tell you guys up front, I subscribe to a lot of ag-related publications. I get Corn and Soybean Digest, Wallace Farmer, Prairie Farmer, Rice Farmer, believe it or not, Ag Professional, and a host of others. Now, with what I'm about to tell you, please know that I'm not running down any of these other magazines. In fact, I like them all. However, what I'm about to share with you could quite literally change your farming operation. It is seriously that good. So, I recently got my very first copy of Crops and Soils magazine. Now, this magazine is a publication of the American Society of Agronomy. Now, I got the official word that I'd passed my exam and my application was accepted to become a certified crop advisor back in June. However, at that point, I guess I didn't understand that that didn't automatically get me a membership with the ASA, which is the American Society of Agronomy. So I shelled out the $100 annual fee and joined the organization. Now, as I said, my first issue of Crops and Soils just showed up, and guys, I gotta tell you, you have got to get this magazine. Yep, it's $100 a year, and that only gets you an electronic subscription. If you want the print version, it's another $35 a year. But seriously, guys, this magazine is unreal. So what's so good about Crops and Soils, and what makes it better than everything else? Well, there's a lot. First of all, although there are advertisements in this magazine, they really are few and far between. Not every page is filled with somebody trying to sell you, whether it's a fungicide or a fertilizer or some piece of equipment. Secondly, the topics and the quality of the articles is amazing. Third and relatedly, the articles have actual references listed to published studies, and often they have a list of additional resources as well. So this is a content-heavy magazine, and one that I think can make a real difference for every grower who's willing to take the time and spend the money to read it. At the end of the day is this, guys. You simply got to get a hold of an issue of this magazine and check it out for yourself. I'm telling you right now, this magazine will make you money. Next, we'll check in with Ben Peterson from Lake Mills, Iowa. But first, this.
Do you have a topic you'd like us to cover in an upcoming episode? Go to dynamiteag.com and send us an email to let us know.
Today's Dynamite Grower Correspondent is one of my very best friends, Ben Peterson from North Central Iowa. Now, if you'll recall, we last checked in with Ben on episode 3 of the show, and at that time, Ben said that they were set up very well for the growing season, although there were a few possible speed bumps along the way. He said that they had excellent emergence and their planting conditions were fair to above average, and that they'd had plenty of water early on, but that it had come slow and steady, which was good. They did catch an early frost right after emergence, and they did see a little damage from that. So I caught up with Ben to get an update.
So for today's episode, we'll check back in with Ben Peterson. Ben?
Yeah, hey, thanks, Kurt. Lake Mills, Iowa. We farm, we raise corn and soybeans here. We are looking at some very, very good crops in the field with great potential at this point. We've weathered, since I spoke to you last, pretty well. We were on the verge of hitting a dry patch and then caught an inch and a half here, what was it, a week and a half ago. And since then, we've had a couple other nice rains to the point where we can't get out and spray fungicide, insecticide right now. Some of our plant applications we had for corn and soybeans, which is kind of a conflicting problem to have. You're happy you got so much moisture at this time of year. But by the same token, we do have some disease insects that we want to get after. So I can't complain too loudly. Potential problems going forward. We've had, with some of these storms that came through, brought needed rain, welcome rain. There were some areas that got hit badly by hail. I'm sure there are other areas that got hit by wind, although I haven't heard of anything major. The point is, in our microenvironment, we're just really thankful that we haven't had the wind and the hail. This hasn't been our turn this year, I guess.
All right, Ben, you were talking about the disease pressure possibly. Are you seeing northern corn, gray leaf spots? What kinds of things are you guys dealing with right now?
Sure, yeah, northern corn leaf blight, primarily in corn, with some eye spot, with some common rust. Northern corn leaf blight is the buzz disease, if you will, in our corn crop up here. It's really having guys looking hard at their fields to see if they want to spray. Soybean-wise, there's been I've heard some reports of some Cercospora, leaf spot, I believe that's how you say it. And then I found a pest I've never seen before in a soybean field. I don't know if it's an economic threshold or not, because I'm not familiar with them, but either green clover worm or soybean looper. It was really bizarre to see it, but they're doing some serious defoliation, so we got to get after them. Soybean aphids, scattered reports of them coming on strong. We haven't seen them personally in our field. But just overall right now, we've got plenty of moisture. If we played the nitrogen game right, we're set up pretty nicely.
Well, knowing about the conditions you've got there, Ben, and now that we're, you know, most of the way through the growing season. We're a good portion of the way through the growing season. At this point, what would you say was the limiting factor, or maybe what will be the limiting factor if you haven't experienced it yet?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've got plenty of heat. Been getting plenty of heat. Moisture. I don't think it's limited us. We went dry, like I said, for a couple of weeks. We were dry. I really don't think things suffered, aside from the really sandier soils in areas. You know, going forward, we will need rains in August, especially for the soybeans, and to get the top end yield on the corn. We'll need wind. It seems like straight line winds that come with storms or fronts. This is just always a bugaboo for us. We always have a field or two that gets knocked sideways to some extent. If nothing else, makes it really difficult to combine. And of course, yeah, normally early frost, which can historically happen, but like we're actually running a little bit ahead of the curve as far as maturity goes. So fortunately, I guess I can report that I don't feel for our crop. We face a whole lot of likely risks. That being said, it's not in the bin by a long shot.
So is it safe to say, Ben, that at this point in the growing season, you feel pretty confident that the limiting factor is going to be the possibility of a future weather event? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, that's assuming we can keep diseases and insects in check with our insecticide, pesticide treatments. Now, there could be, you know, sun death syndrome, soybeans. I've read some reports from some agronomists say we've had a perfect season for that, and there's not a single thing we can do for that in this year to prevent that from taking top end off of soybeans. So I will say that That's something that may happen, and if it does, we're at its mercy. Maybe some white bulls and soybeans, too, if we stay wet and with moderate temperatures. Corn-wise, I feel like our fungicide and insecticide packages should be able to take care of most things. Now, goss is wilt. I have seen, in some places where I normally haven't seen it at this point, some goss is wilt lesions on the lower part of the plant. That's something that's been creeping into our area, and if that breaks hard, it's a bacterial thing. We can't treat that with fungicides. So that's also something to keep an eye on, too. So I probably downplayed the disease factor, pest factor, my initial comment.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
You know, I've made some comments that say, you know, maybe made it seem like I think we've got this thing wrapped up and we've got a bumper crop. That potential exists, but we do face perils ahead, potential perils. I really feel for guys, and I've seen and heard about them, you know, in areas that have had way, way too much rain. I've seen the aerial pictures. It's ugly. So I just, you know, I got to say how fortunate I feel to be able to look at a crop that's got a lot of potential in the field. Now, that being said, the last 3 years around here have been less than bumper crops, 12 and 13 especially. So it's fun, you know, regardless of what the prices are doing. It's fun as a farmer to be able to look out there and see potential for maybe the best crop you've ever raised. But at the same time, you realize the blink of an eye, it can be taken from you. It's the nature of the beast.
I think those are probably pretty astute observations, Ben. Hey, as always, thank you so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Kurt.
Well, there's your update from North Central Iowa. One of the big things that Ben kept hitting on was the potential for disease. And that's obviously pretty relevant to today's episode, which is all about fungicide. We'll dive into that topic right after this.
Hey guys, it's time to register for the 360 Yield Center Proving Grounds, coming up on August 11th, 12th, and 13th. Come see the 360 Y-Drop in action, along with the brand new 360 Chain Rule System that will be available for the John Deere 600 Series and 4090 Series this fall. Also, come meet Dr. Livesey and some of his dynamite growers who will be in attendance. If you'd like to get registered, call Dr. Livesey at 641-919-5574. We'll see you there!
Alrighty folks, let's talk fungicide. More specifically, let's talk about pyraclostrobin, or what's more commonly known as the active ingredient in Headline. Now, I told you earlier that I would explain why I'm focusing on the BASF products, and we've come to the part of the show where I will do just that. So, what I did was I got on the Iowa Soybean Association's on-farm research website, and I started looking at the fungicide data. Because, believe it or not, when I first started researching this podcast, it was actually a couple weeks ahead of when most of you would be out applying fungicide, even though, as I said earlier, I know we're past that, and I apologize for the delay in getting this episode out. So my thought was I would dig into the research and see what's been shown to work well in Iowa. Now, for the record, I also looked at the Nebraska on-farm research as well, but their website is way less user-friendly, and they didn't have a searchable database the way Iowa did, so that's a big reason why I limited this to the Iowa data. So I loaded up all the Iowa fungicide data that compared instances in which a grower used fungicide to the times when they didn't, or basically it was a with versus without. So just to be clear, I did not look at any data that compared, say, you know, Quadris or Quilt or anything like that to Headline, or Stratego to Preaxor or anything like that. So again, these are not head-to-head comparisons. These are simply the fungicide versus no fungicide trials that I looked at here for the data set. Next, I calculated the mean, or the average yield differences. I took all of the data that was two standard deviations above the mean and two standard deviations below the mean, and I threw out that whole data set. So basically everything in the middle. What that left me with was the top roughly 2.5% of yield and the bottom roughly 2.5%. In other words, I was really only interested in looking at when the fungicide really, really, really worked and when it didn't work at all, basically. So I did this because I wanted to analyze some of the common factors and to be able to talk about those on the show. You know, like when it does work versus when it doesn't work. And I really think that's important because there's way too many sales reps out there, whether it's for fungicide or for fertilizer, or heck, even for seed, honestly. And I think that sometimes these overzealous sales reps have a tendency to overpromise and underdeliver, and that's a problem. So as I've said on the show before, guys, there's no product, not even seed, that will work 100% of the time. It's critically important that we match the right seed, for instance, to the right conditions, and that we know when things like foliar feeding, or in this case, fungicide, will work and when they won't work. So with all that said, here's what I found. On both corn and beans, BASF's pyraclostrobin products tend to be the most widely used. Additionally, they were the ones that showed up in the top 2.5% of the best yielders most consistently. So, what is pyraclostrobin?
Pyraclostrobin is a strobilurin fungicide that inhibits mitochondrial energy production. So it works in the mitochondria, in the cells of the fungus. And if you're able to inhibit the mitochondria in the cell, the organism, basically destroying that organism's ability to produce energy. So then the organism's going to starve to death, or the cells are going to starve to death and die.
That's Kurt Martins, tech service representative for BASF for Eastern Iowa and Western Illinois. He's one of the two BASF guys I was able to interview for this podcast. So I asked Kurt to give me a little history of pyraclostrobin.
BASF's first fungicide in the U.S. market, which was a strobilurin-based product, or I should say BASF's first strobilurin fungicide, came out early 90s. But it's used on pretty slim amount of products. I think it might have been used a little bit in wheat, some vegetable crops. From that product there, you know, BASF saw the benefits, the disease control, and some plant health benefits as well. But its range of disease control was somewhat limited, and it was limited on what crops it could be put on. So in their pipeline, they continued to advance their research for different fungicides, different AIs, and that's when they came up with pyraclostrobin, which is the active ingredient in Headline and all the fungicides that we use in corn and soybeans from BASF. That product would have been launched in 2004. Headline, the straight Headline, was launched in 2004.
In addition to my interviews, I read quite a bit of published research on this topic as well. I read an article published in 2014 in a journal called Plant Science Today, and the article was entitled Impact of Pyraclostrobin, or F500, on Crop Plants. In that article, they reviewed a lot of published literature on pyraclostrobin, and they concluded that in addition to its fungicidal properties, it offered other benefits as well. First of all, it enhances plant growth and biomass. Secondly, it increases nitrate uptake, reduction, and assimilation. Third, it regulates phytohormonal levels to overcome stress. Fourth, it alleviates oxidative plant stress. Fifth, it delays leaf senescence. And lastly, probably because of the first five things I've already mentioned, it enhances yield. Now, when I interviewed Kurt, he actually touched on a lot of these points, so I'll let him explain how all this works in greater depth.
BASF fungicides that contain pyraclostrobin, so Headline, Headline Amp, and Preaxor, the only fungicides labeled for plant health. What happens when the plant health product is applied to the plant, goes into the mitochondria in the kind of the same pathway as it does in the disease, but again, this causes the plants to sense that they're energy deprived. So we're not killing off the mitochondria. We're just making the plants sense that it's energy deprived. So when a plant's low on energy, or if you and I are low on energy, what do? We eat something. And so the plants respond the same way when they're energy deprived. They activate processes that increase their energy production. One of those processes would be what we call nitrate reductase, and that's an enzyme. And so when the plants sense that they're hungry, they're going to activate this enzyme. And this enzyme is really important because it's a rate-limiting step in nitrogen assimilation, so basically how the plant uses nitrogen. So when we activate this, the plant's able to utilize nitrogen more efficiently. And if it's able to utilize nitrogen more efficiently, so nitrogen's food for the plant, allows the plant to increase photosynthesis. So then we're going to grow bigger roots. We're going to get greener leaves. We're going to get stronger stalks. And of course, if we're going through the reproductive stages, like our corn is right now, means we're going to put more food or more food available for the plant, so it's going to sink its energy into that grain fill period. So, but a byproduct of nitrate reductase is nitric oxide, NO, Nitric oxide is also increasing in productivity of the plant by increasing photosynthesis. I kind of mentioned that a little bit. Nitric oxide also plays a critical role in stress response. So the nitric oxide reduces a hormone called ethylene, which is a stress hormone in the plant that causes growth inhibition. So if we can reduce the amount of ethylene, reduce the amount of that hormone, we're going to take stress off the plant, which allows the plant, again, to go through more photosynthesis, grow the bigger roots, the greener leaves, the stronger stalks, and have more energy available for that grain fill period in both corn and soybeans. It's really neat. This cycle kind of goes on and on and on. When we think of a residual for a herbicide or even a fungicide, they're only going to last so long. But once we trigger this plant health response in plants, it just continues to build and build and build and build and doesn't really go away after we make that application. That's kind of the neat part of this. So plant health products also activate another enzyme. It's called superoxide dismutase. Kind of a tongue twister. This enzyme is responsible for saving the cells from reduced oxidative stress. Another tongue twister here. Okay, so these reduced oxidative stress molecules damage cells in the plants, and they also work on human cells as well. Reduced oxidative stress is what causes wrinkles in us and sunspots on our skin as we age. Same thing happens to plants. So, again, if we are inhibiting this enzyme, we're taking less stress off that plant. It means we've got more photosynthetic activity in our leaves. So that means the plant's going to be able to go through more photosynthesis. More photosynthesis means more food for the plant. More food for the plant means more energy for, again, the bigger roots, the greener leaves, the stronger stalks, and most importantly, being able to have plenty of energy for that green fill. And lastly, so ethylene, I mentioned ethylene is a hormone. So ethylene is the hormone that causes the maturing in plants. So think of it as the ethylene ripens fruit. It also brings on the senescence of plants. So that's when we're controlling that hormone, we're controlling that senescence. It's kind of one of the reasons why we see the plants stay green longer.
So all of these benefits of pyraclostrobin sure sound nice on paper and all, but do they actually work in the field? To answer that question, I turn to my interview with Nathan Wells. Nathan's official title is Innovation Specialist with BASF, but what that really means is that he's in the field all the time with growers. And most importantly, Nathan is a farmer.
Some of the most positive results we've seen have come from, whenever we have corn that's in a high yield environment already where we've done everything great the rest of the season before and, we're set up for very high yield potentials. Whenever we have a very high yield environment, pyraclostrobin is going to help maintain that high yield level in that plant. So one way to think about how these fungicides are working, we're not taking a yield level and increasing it. We're just keeping the plant at that high yield level and trying to maintain that.
I hope you paid close attention to what Nathan just said. He said that pyraclostrobin does not increase the yield level. Instead, all it does is that it takes an already high-yielding environment, and it essentially protects against yield loss. I love that Nathan explained it this way, because if you've ever heard me speak before, you know that I constantly preach that there aren't any products on the market that can actually increase your yield. And I mean that, guys. There's not. The top producers in the world have already proven that the genetic potential exists for 4 and even 500 bushel corn, and Kip has shown us that you can grow 160 plus bushel soybeans as well. So what does that mean for your farm? Well, it means that we are all really good at suffering yield loss when you think about it. You see, the way that we get a, quote, yield increase, end quote, is very simple. We prevent yield loss. Guys, when and where does starter fertilizer work the very best? In cold, wet soils that are already low in phosphorus and potassium. Why? Because the lack of plant-available nutrients early on causes yield loss. So when we have the right starter fertilizer, we bridge the gap between germination and when those nutrients become available to the plant based on soil temperature, and voila, yield bump. So then, when does pyraclostrobin work best? Here's Kurt again, and this time he's talking about soybeans, but the same philosophy applies to any crop.
I'd say some growers if they just treat beans as that crop that they've got to rotate into in between corn, and they're only getting 40 and 50 bushel yields, my data shows that we just don't see the consistency in that increase in yield from a plant health application. Now, the growers that look at the soybean and take the challenge of raising really good soybeans and high-yielding soybeans and take everything into consideration, like row spacing, plant population, fertility, selecting the correct variety, seed treatments, weed control, when they're taking all those consideration factors under management and really scrutinizing those things and moving those soybean yields up more so in the upper 60 and 70 and even 80 bushel range, that's when we consistently see our plant health products and foliar feeding products consistently show a positive return on investment.
Now, I'm not sure where all Kurt got his data, but I will tell you that his statement is 100% in line with what I saw when I dug into the Iowa on-farm research. More specifically, in the top 2.5% of the yield increases attributable to fungicide application, the average yield of the treatment was 202 bushels per acre, and the check beside it was 186 bushels per acre. In soybeans, it was 61.7 on the treated and 53.5 on the untreated. But guys, the opposite end of the spectrum is also true. Just like Kurt said, in the bottom 2.5% of the yield data from the Iowa on-farm research, and in other words, this is when the application of fungicide actually cost yield or caused a yield decrease, by the way. So in those instances, the corn treated with fungicide yielded an average of 173 bushels per acre, and the untreated was 182. In soybeans, the treatment was 46 and the untreated was 49. So what does all of this mean? It means that if you're not consistently raising 190 plus bushel corn, and or if you're not consistently raising 55 to 60 bushel beans, you shouldn't expect much from the plant health benefits that we've been discussing. Does that mean that you should not apply fungicide, though? Not necessarily. What it does mean is that you should be scouting every day, guys, regardless of your yield environment. If you have disease present, depending on what the disease is, you may need a fungicide even if you're only in a 150 bushel corn environment. Here's Nathan again.
Last year we had very high yield environments, so there was a lot of potential out there, but in some areas, we had a very heavy pressure of northern corn leaf blight that come in, and some of our yield responses were astronomical, anywhere from 20 bushel to some over 100 in some instances, and a lot of that had to do, with some, stock integrity issues, some corn going down, and you're unable to harvest it.
Okay, just so we're on the same page, this is the part where I'm pretty sure that BASF will contact me if I don't give the results not typical disclaimer. But seriously, guys, even though you shouldn't expect to see those kinds of results all the time, if the disease pressure is there in an otherwise very high yielding environment, those kinds of things are actually possible. That doesn't surprise me at all. Now, there's one last important point to hit before we go, and that's timing. Just like everything else, it is crucial that you get the timing correct if you want to see this work consistently. Here's Kurt Martins again.
Optimal timing in corn would be a tassel application of headline N. So all of our data shows that the biggest return on investment, the biggest yield response that you'll get year in and year out when you make a tassel application. So that's accumulation of all of our small plot replicated trials, internal trials, university trials. That's years and years and years of data compiled together, and that's what it always shows. So our main recommendation for growers never used fungicide before would be headline AMP at in between VT and R2, so between tassel emergence and blister. Hopefully, I'd like to see them on the earlier side, closer to the tassel emergence than R2, but anytime in that window, that's going to be its biggest return on investment. As far as soybeans go, we've got a pretty broad window to spray pre-action on soybeans between R2 and R4. The main timing, if someone's planting it, though, is going to be R3. So R3 is when we have one pod 3/16 of an inch long and one of the top four uppermost nodes. So right now, today is July 18th. Most of our beans are R2. We've got some beans that are going to be getting real close to R3, but majority are going to be in R2. So our optimal timing for soybeans is coming up here about another week or two.
All right, guys. At this point, I want to apologize again for the delay in releasing this podcast. I am aware that most of you won't be able to do anything with this info for almost a full year now, but that's the nice part about the podcast. At least it's recorded, so you can listen to it again if you want. Now, I should also tell you that this podcast barely even scratched the surface of what all we covered in the interviews and all of the university research that I read on fungicide as well. But I do try to keep these episodes limited to about a half an hour, so we're coming to the end of our time for this show. I'm especially bummed I didn't have time to discuss with you some new research from the University of Missouri about different leaf nutrient concentrations when using pyraclostrobin, but that research actually gave me an idea for a little experiment that some of my dynamite growers are going to be trying next year. So if you'd be interested in knowing more about that little experiment, or if you've got any questions or comments about today's podcast, please feel free to give me a call at 641-919-5574. Or you can find me on Facebook or Twitter, and also check out our new website that's still under construction over at dynamiteag.com. Now, as I always do, I'm going to end the podcast today with some resources for you to check out on this topic. Today's show focused on the pyraclostrobin family of fungicides offered by BASF. However, while they are the only fungicides with a plant health label, there are other fungicides out there if you're simply trying to treat disease. If you'd like some more info on fungicide efficacy, or in other words, which fungicide to use for which disease, I highly recommend that you download a couple of things from Purdue. Just this year, Purdue Extension released these two new publications about fungicide. One is called Fungicide Efficacy for Control of Soybean Foliar Diseases, and the other is Fungicide Efficacy for Control of Corn Diseases. These are both free, and you should be able to Google them and find them that way. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Ag Talk with the Ag Doc. I'm your host, Dr. Curtis Livesey, saying thanks so much for tuning into the podcast. Be sure to subscribe to it if you haven't already done so. You can find us on the Farm Journal's My Farm Radio app, in iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get the podcast at our website, agtalkwiththeagdoc.com. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, because I do post a lot of info there. And if you have feedback, again, on this episode, the podcast in general, or hey, if you just want to talk general agronomy, please feel free to go to dynamiteag.com and shoot us an email. That's a wrap for this show, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in.